Today is Wednesday, May 8th, the year 2002. We are in East Lansing, Michigan. I am Jeff Charnley interviewing Kathleen Large for the MSU Oral History Project for the sesquicentennial of Michigan State to be commemorated in the year 2005. As you can see, we have a tape recorder to do this oral history today. Do you give us permission to record the interview?
Yes, I do.
Okay. I'd like to start with some general questions about your personal background. Where were you born and raised, and where did you go to high school?
I was born in Lansing, Michigan, raised in Gaylord, Michigan, moved back and finished high school at Eastern High School.
Okay. What year did you graduate?
1951.
Okay. What did you do after high school graduation?
Well, back in those days, if you wanted to be a secretary, you didn't go to college. That was recommended by teachers and counselors. So I sought a job. I had worked at Daniel's Jewelry downtown Lansing while I was in high school on a co-op program in the office, so I knew I liked that kind of work. I came out to Michigan State and applied for a position and got two half-time jobs the first summer. So, and I've been at Michigan State ever since.
What was it that was appealing to you about becoming a secretary at the time?
Oh, I think back in the 1940s and 50s, it wasn't expected that girls were going to work for a long time, that they were going to get married and raise a family, and so the secretarial route was kind of enticing. I liked to type, and I liked the shorthand part. I liked the business part, so it just was a natural.
And did your courses in business courses in high school prepare you with that?
Yes.
In terms of
yes.
Shorthand?
Yes. Yes. I felt that I was well prepared for that.
And you mentioned that you got two half-time jobs at Michigan State. Where were those?
Half-time with what was then Home Economics. Yeah. I worked with a professor, and I cannot think of her name at this time, that was doing a research project that summer, and she needed a half-time person. And we worked on the fourth floor of Human Ecology with a nice sunlight domes. It was very hot that summer. And the other half-time job with what was then called Guidance and Counseling, which was in the College of Education. And I worked for a couple of the counselors there. So it made a full-time job for me.
And what happened in the fall?
In the fall, I went with the Placement Bureau. A position opened up, and it was one full-time position. And there I worked with the high school administrators coming in to hire teachers. And that was rewarding.
What did you like about that job?
I liked the contact with the public and the students. I guess from that point on, I always have worked with students in some way or other. And then from there, I went to Kellogg Center, and I worked in the conference department for a couple of years with the staff that set up the arrangements, the logistics and everything for people to have conferences. And I later became the manager of the conference desk. I loved that job because I did work with outside people from all over the world. That was very rewarding. And then I went with Gordon Spine.
The Kellogg Center is celebrating its 50th anniversary, isn't it?
They opened in 55.
Or 55,
so
okay.
So it'll be 50.
50 years coming up in 2005 also.
Yeah.
Okay. When you worked with Dr. Sabine, what was involved in your work there?
I was his administrative assistant. And he was responsible for the Office of Admissions and Scholarships, as well as the Registrar's Office, plus any task that Dr. Hanna wanted completed. So it was a secretarial role, keeping track of his calendar, talking with students, talking with faculty. There was a lot of communication between the Honors College, the admission staff, a lot of families and students coming in to try to understand why they were denied admission.
Mm-hmm. So that was the tough part.
That was the tough part, yeah. Mm-hmm. A lot of legislators would get involved at that time.
When they were denied admission.
But, right, not when they were admitted. So it was, you know, I mean, he worked with the total university. Mm-hmm. We worked with all the deans, all the chairs. It was just a miscellaneous position. I went with him in 1960. So in 1961 is when we started working with the Merit Scholarship Program. And that all fell under, I guess, my umbrella, because we did all the initial contacting of the students and compiled the mailing lists and so forth, which was quite a detailed operation. I don't know if you want to get into that.
Yes, yes. Let's talk about that. What was involved? Obviously,
when we first started that, the only way you could get the students' names was to get this Merit Semifinalist Annual book that was published by the Merit Corporation in Evanston, Illinois. And the book was available to anyone who desired it on, quote, a particular day, like Monday, September 19th. I just picked that out of the air. It seemed like it was like the third Monday of September. Someone would make a trip. That was available on Monday morning. Someone would make a trip to Evanston, Illinois by car, pick up that book on Saturday morning, get back to the campus, and I had the admissions clerical staff ready to start the procedure to communicate with these students. Prior to that, we had several letters, thousands of letters printed. Back in those days, it was very important to make the letter look personal. So we had to have several typewriters with the same element, because we inserted the salutation. It didn't dare be crooked. It had to line up, and it had to look for real. Mm-hmm. We strived very hard on that, and we did a good job. We, ahead of time, had packets ready. But when we would get that list, I would make a copy of it. It was in order by state, by city, by high school, and then the students within those high schools that were named semifinalists were listed. We would type envelopes to every student in care of the high school along with a principal envelope, because everything had to go to the school. There was no home address at that point in time. So envelopes were hand-typed for, I believe the number was like between 14 and 15,000.
Wow.
We would then add the salutation to the letters. Everything had to be double-checked to make sure that we had the right students in the right school with the right principal, with the right envelopes. We would then stuff the envelopes, and then I arranged with our mail service to work on Sunday as well with us, and they would come in, and as we had the mail stuffed and ready, they would pick it up by the tray loads, take it, process it, seal it, stamp it, and it was in the main post office at 8 o'clock Monday morning.
Wow.
At the time that the book was just being released to the public. Mm. We had a cover letter to the principal letting them know what the contents of the envelopes were, along with the information that we were sending. And we were initially sending the letter, it was a congratulation letter, and encouraging them to think about Michigan State as a college to attend. Mm-hmm. And then if they we had a response card in that, and if they responded, they continued to hear from us on a regular basis.
What offhand do you remember what percentage was of people that responded? Out of the 14 or 15,000, I'm sure it changed every year, but
right. But we got a good percent. It was around 10% of the overall, mm-hmm. which is supposed to be a good percent of return. Mm-hmm. But at that first contact, we were relying on the principals or the guidance counselors, mm-hmm. to be open-minded. Mm-hmm. And to pass this information on. Sometimes they didn't, mm-hmm. you know. But so from that point, if the students, and they had a coded application so that if they chose to file for admission, we knew right then that they were a merit semifinalist. Mm-hmm. We started a mailing list, and Gordon had newsletters going out monthly to the students, and we covered all areas of, you know, admissions, honors college, financial. We promoted the three small colleges because that was very intriguing to that caliber of student. Mm-hmm. They liked that.
And those, Reston those Hall's, three were
Justin Morrill College, which was our first one, then Lyman Briggs and James Madison. Mm-hmm.
Residential college.
Yes. Okay. We also did a newsletter on the Reston Hall themselves, mm-hmm. as well, but the small colleges was a separate one. Mm-hmm.
Okay. Was there discussion about the issues of in-state versus out-of-state at the time? In other words, did you go after the in-state National Merit Scholarships to a higher degree?
No, we treated them all equally.
Okay.
They all got the same treatment. Mm-hmm.
So similar letters.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yep.
Okay. What were some of the things that you recall about? Obviously, that was like, it must have been a horrible weekend, the equivalent of
it was
April 15th for an accountant or something.
Well, it was because there was 20 or 25 staff, mm-hmm. along with myself, and I sort of was the manager of it, you know, mm-hmm. keeping mm-hmm. control of it. And we probably worked from noon until 10 o'clock Saturday, and then we were right back there at 7 o'clock Sunday morning, mm-hmm. until it was done. We worked as a team. We were exhausted, but we were proud of what we had accomplished. Mm-hmm.
Did the procedures change over time?
Yes.
Did the book become available, or some of that information that?
The procedure started to change when Gordon Sabine left. Mm-hmm. A couple of trips were made, I recall, right after that, and then we just waited for the book to come in, and then we went through that same procedure. Then when Bill Turner came on as Director of Admissions and Scholarships, we started using the ACT, SAT results that come out in the spring. Now, keep in mind, we did this in the fall, and the SAT ACT scores came out in the spring when the students were completing their junior year. Mm-hmm. And so we started recruiting the same caliber of student by using test scores, knowing what they normally have for the different state cutoffs. And then we started contacting them in the spring. The letter became generic. We no longer went through that procedure. We also had home addresses. And at that time, you could get the addresses off the database. So now we were slapping labels on envelopes instead of hand typing. It made the task a lot easier. It still took the whole admission staff to do it, and our goal was to get in the mail before anyone else did. And I think we probably succeeded in that 80% of the time. But I always felt that it was a little down key from what we did before.
When was this? Dr.
Well,
Sabine
I'm
left
trying
in 1970.
To think. Dr. Sabine left in 1970. The first year, Horace King, who was the registrar at that time, took it on as acting director. Then Ira Polly came in. But Ira sort of was like a Gordon Sabine. He was like an assistant to the provost, and he had Charles Seeley, who was one of our admission counselors. Well, I'm trying to think. I think Turner had 15 years of service when he retired. It's been gone a couple of years, and I left in 91, so about 85. Just about 85.
So for about
5-6 years, this is how we did it. The latter part. And we also we recruited the commended students. I'm sure you realize it. There's another cutoff.
Tell me about that.
Well, there's a cutoff score that's established by the Merit Corporation to make a student a semifinalist versus a commended student. A commended student probably is at the 3-point, between a 3-point and a 3.5 as far as GPA is concerned, or it was. Today I don't know, but it was then. And then we recruited them in the same way, but we didn't have financial aid to offer them like we did with the merit scholarships, because they could only go to semifinalists. And they had to reach finalist status. And then we used similar things. We had newsletters that went to them, as well as the National Achievement semifinalists. And those are your Black American students.
Do you remember what the main pitch was? Why they should come to Michigan State? Was there any strategy?
Why they should come to Michigan State? Because we have the Honors College to offer you. You know, you can make up your own agenda of what you want. We've got all these honors faculty to work with you directly.
So the Honors College was targeted with...
Oh, yes.
I mean, they were...
They were always very much involved.
What were some of the other, besides admissions, if you think about your workload, you talked about that, and then what was involved in your work after you got this mass of letters out and that sort of thing, the correspondence came in?
Dealing with this, selecting the students for their scholarships. The admissions office kept, there was a break at one time when scholarships went with financial aid. And that was also after Gordon, probably a couple of years. Might have been 72, 73. The scholarship program was turned over to financial aids, but we kept all freshman scholarships for our staff to determine who the students were going to be. The financial need criteria and everything was always the same.
To what degree at that time was the federal government involved? Or did the university have more independence then than now?
I don't think so, because as far as need was concerned, it was determined by federal regulations.
I see.
We still had to follow
so
that.
So during that time, with either federal loan programs or grants or...
Well, the admissions office only dealt with scholarships with, some of them were no need, but they were really the merit ones.
I see.
The merit and your ADS students.
Which was?
And your national achievement.
And that was the Alumni Distinguished
Scholarship.
Program. We commonly refer to it as ADS.
We call it ADS. Some people call it ADS.
And they just celebrated their our first reunion on campus.
That was fun. Seeing people that you remembered but can't associate, put their name with them right away and embarrassed that you can't.
Did the students remember you?
Yes. Yeah. Yes. Several of them were hoping that Gordon Sabine and I would be there because they went back a long ways. Yeah. In fact, John Forsythe was one of the very first ones that I met, and we've been friends ever since. And that would have been when I started with Gordon, because John was working as a student in our office. Extra work.
And he attended that day?
Yes, John was there. Mm-hmm. Jim Anderson. Mm-hmm. Eric Goldman. I know them. Mm-hmm.
And some stay down as professors here.
Yes. Mm-hmm. In fact, I think there's five or six that have continued to stay here, mm-hmm. which is, of course, Paul Hunt and mm-hmm. Kathy Hunt. And John and Eric, and there was another one that I didn't realize, and his name escapes me right at the moment. Mm-hmm. I knew that day, but I don't today.
Mm-hmm. What was your relationship with any of the presidents or provosts at that time? Did you have contact with them?
Oh, yes.
Yeah. Would you talk a little bit about Dr. Hannah?
Well, Dr. Hannah, of course, we were right around the corner from each other, so mm-hmm. There was a lot of contact because of the special projects that he would ask Gordon to do. Mm-hmm. Not too much with Dr. Wharton, and I don't know why, other than I think when Dr. Sabine left, see, then there was no vice president for special projects. Mm-hmm. So our line of communication was through, like, Ira Polly, that it was assistant to the provost, and then Barb Steidel came on as assistant to the provost. So our communication to the provost or president would have been through them mm-hmm. more directly than what it was when Gordon was here.
Mm-hmm. I see. So the university administrative structure changed,
yeah,
with mm-hmm. transition from Hannah to Wharton.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Okay. How did some of those changes affect what you did?
I don't recall that it really affected mm-hmm. how we operated. Mm-hmm. We operated like we always did.
Mm-hmm. Going back to Dr. Hannah, what were some of the personal contacts you had with him, or how would you describe him as everyday work?
Just every day, you know, good morning. Mm-hmm. You knew his family mm-hmm. because they had to walk past you. We were in and out of each other's offices, you know, on a daily basis. All of his administrators were right there. The Jim Dennison, who was his right hand press man, you know, was like supposed like this, okay. you know, and his Phil May. I mean, we were all in the same building.
Mm-hmm. What building was that?
Actually, that is what is now Linton Hall.
Linton Hall.
Mm-hmm. On the top floor. Mm-hmm. And we got our daily exercise by going up the back flight of steps because there was no elevator, and I don't know if there is today or not.
There is today.
Is it today?
Now, right.
They probably were forced to put one in.
The dean of College of Arts and Letters is there now.
There is. Oh, really?
Yep.
Up on the
mm-hmm.
top floor.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the boardroom is restored.
And okay.
Very nicely.
Good.
I think John Eadie did that.
Okay.
When he was dean.
Yeah. Well, and back then, of course, we knew all the Board of Trustees.
Uh-huh.
Because they also were involved with denial admissions, mm-hmm. you know. But they also would come into the office, and their board meetings were right there. So it was a very close relationship back in those days. I mean, you know, they could call you by your first name, and you know who they were.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. That's interesting. How would you describe the relationship between Dr. Sabine and President Hanna?
Oh, very good. Mm-hmm. Very good. I never knew a soul that had problems with Dr. Hanna.
Mm-hmm.
It just, I don't know if it was just being cooperative on both ends or, mm-hmm. you know, I mean, everyone respected the man, and if he had an idea, you'd see that it was fulfilled.
Mm-hmm. The admissions or the university, obviously you were here during the time of great expansion.
Yes.
In terms of numbers and
yes.
physical expansion of that. How did that affect your, how did that affect your job?
How did that affect my job? I continued to do the same things. It increased staff.
Okay. So you changed the size of your staff too.
Changed the size of staff, mm-hmm. yeah. Until they made us cut budgets.
Uh-huh.
And then, of course, you know, then everybody takes on more or it takes longer.
when did the budget cutting start?
Oh, boy.
I
remember it more during the Turner years.
Yeah. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Right. Under President Wharton?
That would have been under Wharton, DiBiagio.
Okay. Mackey?
Mm-hmm. Mackey.
Mackey.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
So, and here we're doing it again.
Well, so, did the campus activism of the 1960s, how did that affect your work, what did you see about how the students reacted?
What I remember about that is that we were locked into the administration building mm-hmm. one time. Other than that, they didn't affect the admissions office.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I think the resident halls got hit more with that than
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And demonstrating.
And there must have been some.
And I went through a union strike
mm-hmm.
where when we had to cross the lines
mm-hmm.
because we were administration.
Mm-hmm.
That didn't bother me.
No. The issues of, what were the key issues on the labor issues there? Do you remember?
Higher wages.
Mm-hmm.
That's one that I think was always out there foremost.
Mm-hmm. And this is for...
But not better working conditions. They couldn't ask for better working conditions
uh-huh.
at the university.
The other Honors College and the Alumni Distinguished Scholarship Program, did that change over the course of time, or were there some constants?
Just a couple of things changed. Of course, the students were invited in January for the competition in February. In 61 until 70 or 71, all the invitations, everything associated with it was handled by the admissions office, so that my only involvement was after they had taken the test and Gordon wanted data accumulated and so forth. But when he left, I was asked to take on the merit program and the ADS program, of which I did. And one of the biggest changes we went through with the ADS program was that students used to be housed in the Risdon halls. And for the first couple of years that I was working with it, we all of a sudden started, students, MSU students had to commit themselves so that we knew where we were going to house students. And it got to the point that maybe 2 days before students were coming on campus, you might decide to change your mind, you might decide to go home, you don't want anyone in your room while you're gone for the weekend. Sickness, and the last time we had a, there was a big chicken pox outbreak. And I thought, I'm not going through this one another year, because it was just too difficult to at a late time to find enough space. We did, but it was kind of overwhelming. So that was probably one of the biggest changes, is that we took the students out of the Risdon halls unless they had personal friends or friends off campus that they could stay with. We started putting them up at Kellogg Center, Butterfield, and I had used the Holiday Inn over by Frandor. I had used Harley and University Inn to put the students in, which today I understand the students are responsible for their own housing.
Were you ever involved in any of the interviews where they went out?
Yes.
Went to the high schools?
I had quite a trip.
What was that?
I just went out 1 year because we were short-staffed. But I had a couple of interviews in